that isn't is shaped by the past. We are not exactly repeating history, but we live with those legacies. And in my book, when I look at this period, Reconstruction, that immediately followed the Civil War, I talk a lot about how ex-Confederates, insurrectionists, got away with literally with murder. Right. They launch a program of domestic terrorism. They have committed treason against the government of the United States. And very soon, because of an amnesty law, they're back in power. They may have lost the war, but they win the peace. And that represents what I call a nadir in American democracy. I don't think many American citizens may be even aware that we have lost our democracy for decades, certainly in the South, where it was open season on freed people, and you had a regime of racial terror, segregation, and disfranchisement for Black men and later on Black women. And I don't think we can today go down a path where we similarly have a completely emasculated democracy. We live with the legacies of that period, as I mentioned to you, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which is a Reconstruction era amendment, is a sleeping giant. It does prevent someone who has participated in or aided and abetted an insurrection from ever running for federal office. Someone who has sworn an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution. And the only way that person can do that is to be pardoned by Congress by a two-thirds vote. Now, it was very disappointing to me that the Supreme Court in the Trump versus Colorado case decided, including the liberal judges, that Trump, in fact, is not liable under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. In fact, he is. It's a very clear disqualification. Now, Congress could take away the disqualification for him. The idea that this would create a patchwork system where different states would then take Biden off the ballot actually does not work, because Biden has not led an insurrection against the government of the United States or proven false to his oath of office. This would be actually a national disqualification, even though the case stem from Colorado. So our Supreme Court did not have the, I think, the moral courage or judicial courage to do this. They thought only expediently about the political fallout from their decision. Instead, 12 ordinary American citizens defended our democracy. And this is exactly what Abraham Lincoln said on the eve of the Civil War, that the fate of our democracy actually lies in the hands, not of the rich and powerful, but in the hands of ordinary American citizens. And if you looked at the jurors, a lot of them didn't seem to me particularly anti-Trump. In fact, I thought maybe there's going to be a hung jury, even though the prosecution had an airtight case. So for this decision to come down sort of renews my faith in democracy, that if ordinary people, ordinary citizens get the chance to really deliberate on Trump's many crimes and misdemeanors, then perhaps we will get a right decision.
I wanted to end by asking you about a related story in the Supreme Court. Of course, President Trump appointed 3 of the 9 Supreme Court justices. And I wanted to ask you about this latest controversy around Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, who told Congress he will not recuse himself from cases involving Donald Trump in the January 6th Capitol insurrection after photos emerged of 2 flags associated with election deniers flying in front of Alito's homes in Virginia and New Jersey. He said his wife did it, one of those upside-down American flag. So there are many who are demanding that he recuse himself from these cases. He says no. Your response, Professor Sinha?
Yes, you know, the Supreme Court in U.S. history has not distinguished itself as a defender of democracy. Think of Dred Scott. Think of Plessy versus Ferguson. The Warren Court during the civil rights era emerges as an exception. We've had partisan judges before, but we have not had corrupt judges. We have not had judges sympathetic to insurrection against the government of the United States, whether it was Alito or his wife, whether it is Thomas or his wife. These two judges are clearly involved in planned insurrection against the government of the United States, or at least are displaying their sympathy for it very openly by flying an upside down American flag, which is a sign of disrespect, and the appeal to the heavens flag. The idea of simply, you know,
the appeal to heavens flag is that pine tree flag.
Exactly. The passing the buck on to his wife seems really ironic for somebody like Alito, who has taken away a women's fundamental right to decide for themselves how and what they do with their bodies. He has taken away reproductive freedom from a majority of women, and now he tells us that he bowed to the decision of his wife to display flags that were sympathetic to the January 6th insurrectionists. You mentioned that you had interviewed me immediately the day after, and even though I'm a historian who has studied American history and knows that there have been instances of grave danger to democracy in U.S. history, I was shocked, and you could see the shock in my face. To have a justice of the Supreme Court who is supposed to uphold the highest laws of the country be active participant in this sort of behavior is just astounding. And the shamelessness of it is similarly astounding, that he would, after being sort of outed by the press, that he would refuse to recuse himself. Frankly, I think both Thomas and Alito are completely compromised, besides being very corrupt. They should either resign or, at the very least, recuse themselves. And I think it's about time for the Democrats to take a more aggressive position on this. At this point, we are not talking about some slight convention that has been upturned. This is a real threat to American rights and freedom. And we need to, you know, Biden likes to compare himself to FDR. Well, then think about packing the court. Think about judicial reform. We need to act against this. We cannot just let Alito decide for himself, because he's clearly incapable of making the right decision.
Manisha Sinha, I want to thank you for being with us. Historian of U.S. politics, slavery, abolition, the legacy of the Civil War and Reconstruction, professor at the University of Connecticut. When we come back, we speak with two more Biden administration officials who've resigned in protest over the administration's support for Israel's war on Gaza. One official from the USAID and the other from the State Department. Back in 20 seconds. ريحة عطر شعرك الفواح ممدود بعينك هالكحل ممدود حناك بن مزخرف ومفروض عابود ودعتك أنا بعابود من حيف انزفك لا بحر أسدود مربوط قلبك بالهوى Tufa by Yusor Hamed, featuring Maisa Dahl. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our next guest was a contractor for the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. He resigned in protest over the Biden administration's support for the war on Gaza. For the past 4 years, Alex Smith worked as a senior advisor on gender, maternal health, child health and nutrition at USAID. Last week, he was scheduled to deliver a presentation on maternal and child mortality among Palestinians to a conference of USAID's colleagues and partners. But a day before he was scheduled to present, the leadership at USAID canceled his presentation. Smith says he was then given a choice between resignation and dismissal. He chose to resign. In his letter of resignation addressed to the head of USAID, Samantha Power, he wrote, quote, I cannot do my job in an environment in which specific people cannot be acknowledged as fully human, or where gender and human rights principles apply to some but not to others, depending on their race. I can no longer in good conscience continue to be silent amidst USAID's de facto policy of ignoring human suffering when that suffering is perpetrated by an ally, Smith wrote. Alex Smith joins us now from Portland, Maine, in his first broadcast interview. Alex, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what happened, how your presentation was canceled. It was a competition for having this place, this address, where Samantha Powers also addressed the conference. Can you talk about what happened?
Good morning. Yes, absolutely. I would like to talk about what happened, but I also do want to keep the focus on the people of Gaza and the West Bank, and not make the headline about a privileged white guy who resigned his job. But yes, I'm happy to talk about what happened. Back in February, I submitted an abstract to the conference. It's a global gender equality conference that was going to be held in May. And that abstract was one of 368 that were submitted. One of the themes of the conference was going to be on intersectionality and maternal health. And I thought this would be an excellent opportunity to talk about Gaza. As we know, there are severe limitations for women to reach health facilities, where previously Gaza used to have very good attendance of skilled birth attendants. Now almost all of the hospitals are non-functioning. And so I submitted my abstract. To my surprise, it was accepted in March. It went through three tiers of review. There were about 35 reviewers involved, and it was outsourced to an outside organization to review as well. So it was accepted, and I was very excited, and I was thrilled to have a chance, a platform, to talk about maternal and child health outcomes in an ongoing crisis. The day before, the Monday before the Wednesday that I was going to present, I was told that I needed to meet with the Middle East Bureau colleagues and submit my slides. I did that. The slides went through many layers of editing and comments. I received a language guide. I was told to remove words like Palestine, Palestinians, Israel, Gaza border, and several others. And then there was a column of preferred language. I went along with that. I removed the word Palestine from the organization name UNFPA Palestine because that was objected to. I removed a map that UN OCHA provided that was acknowledged as an accurate map, but that couldn't be included because it showed the borders and the sea borders of Gaza. Also on that Monday, I was told this is a very sensitive issue because an hour before we were having our chat, the ICC request for an indictment came down from the prosecutor. And so I was told that it's a sensitive issue because of that. I mentioned that I was a legal fellow at the ICC back when I was in law school, that I had worked on specifically starvation as a weapon of war, and that was an area of interest of mine, and that I thought it would be useful to talk about international humanitarian law as they apply to every country, Gaza included. And I think that set off alarm bells. There were many more layers of editing, and then on Tuesday I was told that the presentation was canceled before I was told the presentation was deleted from the conference website.
I wanted to ask you about another part of your letter. You write, USAID defends human rights norms and international law when Ukrainians suffer from Russia's crimes. In Ukraine, we call for legal redress when people are victimized, name perpetrators of violence. We even work with human rights organizations collecting evidence for international prosecution. When it comes to Palestinians, however, we avoid saying anything about their right to statehood, the abuses they're currently suffering, or which powers have been violating their basic rights to freedom, self-determination, livelihoods, and clean water. What was their response to this?
There has been no response to my letter specifically, but that brings up a very important point, that we are very vocal. We don't just deliver aid. We're vocal about human rights, democracy issues. When it's other countries or where adversaries are harming people, but we don't talk about it when it's people in Gaza and the West Bank.
So I wanted to talk about the head of USAID, Samantha Power. In fact, I believe she was one of the people President Biden sent to Michigan to deal with the uncommitted vote and to talk to Arab Americans. She, as head of USAID, was the first top Biden administration official to publicly acknowledge that famine is present in northern Gaza. I wanted to go to a clip. She was questioned by House Democrats Joaquin Castro during a congressional hearing. Congressmember Castro said, so there's famine already occurring there? Samantha Power said, yes. Castro then asked Power how many children were at risk of dying in the coming weeks due to famine. She said, in northern Gaza, the rate of malnutrition prior to October 7th was almost zero. It's now one in three. One in three kids. So was she aware of the demand that was made of you to change all the language?
I don't know. I don't know who in leadership was told about the presentation. I know that there was a lot of chatter that I wasn't privy to about my presentation in the days leading up to it. But I don't know if she has seen the presentation slides or my resignation letter.
So, Alex Smith, you have your moment here. Your presentation was canceled. You're an expert in infant and maternal mortality. You were talking about the Palestinians in the speech you weren't able to give. Tell us, what is the situation?
So my presentation would have looked at snapshots of public health data, DHS data, that USAID funds. Leading up to 2022, it would have talked about some of the challenges of not having clean water, of not having food security in most of Gaza, and also the checkpoints in the West Bank, that there have been risky roadside births before 2023. And then, of course, it would have talked about the impact of not having access to hospitals, of not having access to any maternity care, of having UNFPA provide home birth kits to try to prevent infection. But I really wanted to talk, I wanted to get the point across that if you stop food from going in and then you do start it again, it's not like flipping a switch where everything is fine. The starving pregnant women and children is going to have long consequences. It's going to have lifelong consequences for those people. It can even have epigenetic consequences for future generations. And I think it was important to understand that starvation as a weapon of war is illegal, and we need to acknowledge, and Samantha Power has acknowledged that, that there is a famine, but we need to take that next step of saying it is illegal, and who's doing the starvation intentionally.
I want to end by turning to Samantha Power, the head of USAID, the author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. This was an award-winning book that she wrote. In 2008, Democracy Now! Spoke with Samantha Power about the 94 Rwanda genocide, a period of around 100 days in which up to a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu militias, while powerful countries like the U.S. stood by and refused to stop the mass killings.
President Clinton didn't even call a cabinet meeting for the entire 100 days of the genocide, insisted on the withdrawal of peacekeepers, refused to pay for radio jamming, which would have blocked the radio that was being used not only to propagate the hate, but also to broadcast the names and addresses of potential victims who were getting away. I mean, it was an all-systems failure, but President Clinton was at the helm of that failure, and I think it's an American outrage, and I think President Clinton himself has made that plain, that it's the greatest regret of his presidency.
The greatest regret of his presidency. Samantha Power would go on to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Alex Smith, can you share your final thoughts as we go from President Clinton to President Obama to now President Biden?
Surely. On the same day that I was supposed to give my talk on maternal and child health outcomes in Gaza, the Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs, Dermer, went on Sky News and told millions of people that there is no famine. There never has been a famine in Gaza. And I think it's shameful that that misinformation can go around the world to millions while we at USAID can't even whisper about it in a conference on gender and human rights and health outcomes. So I would like our leaders to do better. I would like them to stop gaslighting and say and speak truthfully about what is happening. We haven't seen that yet, and I think it's long overdue.
Alex Smith, we want to thank you for being with us. Just resigned as contractor for U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, in this exclusive interview. We'll also link to your letter that you wrote to USAID. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today with another Biden administration official who resigned over the administration's support for the war on Gaza. Stacey Gilbert served as senior advisor in the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, which is the State Department's chief humanitarian office and features heavily in internal policy discussions over Gaza. This week, she sent an email to staff explaining her disagreements with a recently published State Department report that she worked on, but which concluded that Israel was not obstructing U.S. humanitarian assistance to Gaza. That report was used by the Biden administration to justify continuing to send more than $1 billion of weapons to Israel. Stacey Gilbert resigned after working at the State Department for over 20 years, joining us now from Baltimore, Maryland. Stacey, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain your final decision to resign.
Thanks for having me. I have, about myself, I've worked for the State Department for a while, and it's not just working in the State Department. I've worked in humanitarian issues, refugee crises, basically most every refugee and humanitarian crisis involving conflict in that time. So Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, Afghanistan. My role in all of this specifically was supporting our team that oversees assistance to Gaza and the Middle East, but specifically working on this report. We were directed in early February by the White House to come up with a report that assesses different countries based on two things primarily. One is their adherence to, as Alex mentioned, international humanitarian law, which is the law that says there are wars, but there are rules in war. There's rules about the kind of weapons you can use, about making the distinction between civilians and combatants. And basically, it's a body of laws that says even in war, there are ways that you have to mitigate the consequences for civilians and soldiers. And we adhere to that. Israel adheres to it. It is international law. So this report was looking at adherence to that body of law, as well as whether countries allow humanitarian assistance. There were several countries we were assessing, but the one, unsurprisingly, that generated the most debate was Israel. I was working on this report with many others. There were a handful of us who were very, very engaged in every sentence of that. But at some point, we were removed from that report, and it was moved up to a higher level to be written and edited and cleared. Even though I had worked on this pretty heavily since this directive from the White House came out in early February, I did not know what was in the report until it came out. That said, I was actually hopeful that it would be a honest report, because earlier that week, the White House had made an announcement that it was going to pause the 2,000-pound bombs that have really caused disproportionate destruction in Gaza. So they had announced a pause on that, and I was actually pretty hopeful that maybe this report was going to be honest. So when the report came out on May 10th, late in the day, I read it and I had to reread it because I couldn't believe what it said. It said very clearly, so on those two points, I was surprised on the point about Israel's adherence to international humanitarian law. for the first time I'm aware of, we admitted in very, very weak terms, but we admitted that Israel is likely using U.S. weapons in violation of international humanitarian law. I was surprised. That was a step forward in admitting that. I was shocked, however, that it also went on to say that Israel, it is our assessment that Israel is not blocking humanitarian assistance. That is not the view of subject matter experts at the State Department, at USAID, nor among the humanitarian community, and that was known. That was absolutely known to the administration for a very long time, not just within the government, but having received reports and letters from organizations on the ground in Gaza, organizations the U.S. government funds, credible organizations saying Israel is blocking humanitarian assistance. And that's not to say that Israel is the only problem in this. There are certainly, it's a conflict, it's difficult. But these are professional organizations with expertise, local knowledge. They know how to work in conflicts. They know how to get to do the negotiations, to get the assistance to where it needs to be. They know how to do it. The issue is they are not being allowed to. And it's a range of issues. It's not just blocking trucks from going in, because we see over the course of this conflict, sometimes trucks go in, sometimes they're delayed, sometimes assistance goes in, but then it's ratcheted back. But we're seeing consistently through this a pattern of obstruction that the aid that prevents these organizations from doing their work and delivering this assistance to the people who need it. It's a variety of things. It's blocking, it's delaying or blocking visas for aid workers. It's causing trucks to be unloaded because there is a single item that Israel considers dual use. And the things that are considered dual use are incredible. Tent poles, flashlights, surgical scissors. All of these things, if found to be in a load of assistance, will cause the whole thing to be offloaded, back everything up. And it's this pattern of arbitrarily limiting, restricting, or just outright blocking assistance going in that has caused the very grave situation in Gaza that we've heard about. Famine. This is not hunger. Famine is a word that we are very, very cautious about using in the humanitarian sector. Words like famine and starvation are only used when very specific indicators have been met. So the fact that there is famine is extraordinary. That doesn't have to happen in a conflict, but it has happened here. And the remedy, when you've reached the stage of famine, the remedy is not more food. Absolutely more food is needed. But for people who are experiencing that extreme stage of malnutrition, that requires an immediate intensive medical intervention. And where are you going to find that in a country now where the hospitals have been destroyed? It's for the people who've reached that stage, it's too late. And any effort to bring in more food is absolutely necessary, but anything that comes in now it's too little too late. And the reason we've come to this point is because of Israel's obstruction. And to see that written in a report, a joint report from the State Department and the Department of Defense to Congress is ludicrous. And I was just...
Stacey, we just have 30 seconds. Your final message to President Biden.
Do the right thing. Listen to your experts. Do the right thing. It is difficult, but it is necessary because what we've done up to now has not worked for anyone. It doesn't help Israel. It doesn't help
the
people
of Gaza. And what is the right thing in this last 10
seconds? The right thing is to acknowledge Israel is blocking humanitarian assistance, and there are consequences of that. And the consequences affect our military sales.
Stacey Gilbert, we thank you so much. Former senior civil military advisor in the State Department has just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.